Hello, everybody. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Dom, and I'm here with Colin. Colin, how are you doing today?
Hello, I'm very excited to be your Colin Stone for this evening.
Well, thank you. And so, for the observant listeners among you who are thinking, well, hold up, Reynold, that's not Colin. Colin is buried in the frozen tundra of Maine somewhere. And so, we had to get a guest host in for the episode. And I thought, what better opportunity to launch a coup, take control of the podcast, and colonize it with as many British people as I like. And so I thought the best person to have would be Sarah Freeman, who until recently was writing a blog about Survivor for IHAP. It's on a hiatus this season, but from what I hear, that might be about to change.
Yes, aside from living the dream on this podcast, being all British, I am hoping to maybe write a blog after the merge, because I've got a few things to say, which I'll also be saying on this podcast, so this will be a preview. And of course, I will definitely be back for season 30. This is just a brief hiatus from blogging due to, responsible grown-up things that I have to do in real life. So.
Luckily, I'm not at the age where I have to think about those things yet.
Yeah, it's this big mistake I made getting married and having a family.
Right. So let's hear some of those thoughts because I know you haven't been writing about the season so far, and you have 5 or 6 episodes worth of thoughts that have built up. So
Yes.
I imagine there isn't much to say as there would be about last season, for instance, where I know for people like us who are taking time out of our weeks to write about the show and talk about the show, there was ample food for thought after every single episode.
Oh,
And
yeah. Cagayan was, that was a case of not enough hours in the week to write about all the things that were happening.
Right. Whereas this season, it's been a change of pace. I don't know if you'd say it's been a welcome change of pace. You certainly don't have the same kind of high octane excitement that you had every single episode last season. So is that a good thing in your view, or would you prefer to see us go back to that?
Well, seeing as I couldn't blog about this season, I am delighted we're having a slow season. But it's a case where, yeah, you really had to adjust and start finding the new balance to appreciate the season, which yeah, I've got into the flow of the season now, appreciating for what it is, a slower pace, a different, very different group of people, much more casual as fans and gamers. But it's Survivor. I always enjoy a Survivor season on some level, even if I won't necessarily be going back to rewatch it. So.
Sure. Do you think it is just that comparison with what came before it that hurts this season? Because I know with Nicaragua, people said the same thing, where coming off Heroes versus Villains, it was almost impossible for any season to top that or to reach the same level, and so that season suffered by comparison. Do you think it's the same way here, where if you looked at it in isolation or compared to maybe a different season, if that had been the previous one, then we might look upon it more favorably?
I think in isolation, this is always going to be a slower paced season. I would say the cast in some ways remind me a bit more of One World. Perhaps I think there's even fewer gamers than the One World cast had. So yeah, I think it's a slow season. There are some likable characters on it. I'm sure we'll get a few good moments, but I think in history, it's going to go down as one of these quieter seasons. There'll be a few ardent fans who are always supporting it on the message boards and things, but I think in general, no, this is. That's not really. I think I'm enjoying it, as I said. Just. Yeah, not a bad season, but yeah, slow season.
That's interesting because I think with One World, the problem was you had Kim, who was so far and away above not only her own cast, but maybe all the other players across Survivor who have ever played before. And then the people that she was playing against were just really not giving her any competition at all. Whereas this season, you don't have anyone in the same kind of pantheon with Kim. You have a few maybe capable gamers, and I'm sure we'll talk about them in a bit more detail. But I feel like the people on the bottom, who they're having to get through are also more capable in their own right. You don't have the same kind of Leafs or Tarzans this season where you know from the first episode that you can just write them off straight away.
My take on the One World cast was always that you had all these big fans of the game on the men's tribe who were there with their own wacky ideas of how to play it. And then the women's tribe was full of recruits, and I think Kim and Nina. And Nina went home early, and Kim just waltzed through the game while the men took each other out because they were all intent on making big, crazy moves. So there was a big gulf between Kim in both the dominant position she ended up in and the players that were in her alliance, ability-wise. And there isn't that same big gulf, I think, between anybody in this cast, you're right. But I do think we've also got this just general, there's a high amount of people who just don't really know how to play and are just taking it slowly, carefully, with a few fans who are overplaying their hand. But the editing's been a bit weird because the fans seem to be getting the most invisible edits. So, you know, I think somebody like Josh this season, he seems to be getting a bit knocked in the things, but I think there's a lot I see of Kim in his gameplay, which I'm sure people would take as heresy because, oh my gosh, Kim, she's perfect, how dare you? But I think Josh has got that same sort of charm that Kim had. Everybody likes Josh. And, yeah, he had that sort of weird sort of waffling thing where he voted for Baylor. That sort of impulse at tribal council, which is just, you know, it's his first tribal council. He made a mistake. I don't really hold that against him. I think since then he's probably played a fairly solid game, a bit tentative, but he's got all the connections. And I think Josh's biggest problem is perhaps Reed, but it's hard to say because we haven't seen Reed's play because he's been invisible. I think that's where the real difference comes in because obviously Kim was on her own and she could define her own game, whereas everybody this season is going to be partly defined by their loved one, unless their loved one got voted out too early.
Well, firstly, Kim is perfect, and how dare you? But okay. Secondly, I think I do agree with what you say about Josh being handicapped by Reed, who it's difficult because we can't really speak to what extent that's happening, precisely because we haven't seen anything off Reed so far. When you read between the lines and you look at the interviews, you hear people saying, oh, Reed is quite shifty and he's overplaying his hand and he's really doing a lot that could conceivably drag Josh down. But we're just not being shown that as the audience, so it's unclear what we're supposed to make of that.
Yeah. What we know about Josh and Reed is that probably more than anybody else, these are the pair where both of them were really big fans of the show. They were both interested in applying. It's not like one was there and the other one is there plus one. They are both sort of there on their own enthusiasm. And the impression I get from Reed is that he's really excited to play the game. He's trying to do all these moves. It's like Pete Yakowski planting the idol in RC's bag. But so he's trying to do all those moves and be sneaky. And it's the other casts are just picking up on it. And you see him, I feel sorry for Reed in some ways because he's there, he's very vocal at the arena. He's the spokesperson in half of these trades with Jeff. But we're just not getting the camera time. The only thing we've seen is we've seen when Keith sort of suggested that Jeremy had the island, Reed took that back to Jeremy to stir up trouble. But we've not seen what alliances Reed thinks he has, and yeah, it's frustrating because I feel like Reed is actually a major part of the dynamic that's going on there, but we're just not seeing him.
Right, and it seems like they do this a lot where they kind of work backwards from the fact that somebody doesn't end up being a big factor long term, and so they don't really see any reason to build that edit up in the first few episodes. The problem, though, is that when it does come down to that episode when maybe their vote is in question or somebody's relying on them, we really have no indication as to which way they're going to go, and then also no reason to care about which way they do go because we barely have any idea of who they are. I know this in Karamoan, we kept saying this was a big problem because every single episode it was, well, maybe Eric and Brenna could make something happen, but we know they won't because we've seen maybe 5 minutes of them combined over 10 episodes.
Yeah, exactly. I will say I think the edit this time has been a lot better than the previous Blood and Water season, where at this point we all knew that Aris was going to be the merge boot. And we had a pretty good idea that Tyson seemed like to be the winner, and that was like within a few episodes of the merge, we all knew really that Tyson was going to win. So at least this season, I've got an idea. I've got my theories as to what's going to happen at the merge, but I don't feel like it's been telegraphed quite as clearly. But in the first Blood vs. Water, I felt like the cast did a really good job of making the game exciting and the editors did a great job of sucking all the suspense out of it. Whereas this season, everyone just seems a bit muddled. You know, it's like the cast are a bit muddled with what they're doing and the editors aren't sure how to handle it.
Yeah, I might have agreed with you on all of that before this week. I feel like in this episode, it was kind of drummed into our skulls, maybe not as overtly as the Arse thing was in season 27, but it feels much more obvious now than it did before that Josh is going to be the target at the merge. Whereas before, I know we and other people were saying, well, Jeremy seems like the archetypal merge boot, and Josh is going to be the one running the show from there. Since the swap, though, it seems like there's been a complete reversal where Josh really hasn't got much content at all as it relates to the game, and Jeremy is taking every opportunity to talk about the game and also to talk about Josh. I know one of the things that people flagged up with Tyson and Arse was Tyson would always talk about Arse, but Arse would never talk about Tyson, and that was a real big red flag as to what was going to happen there.
Oh, actually, I never thought about that. You're right. Yeah, I know Josh is certainly my pick for the merge boot. I think in general, though, it's not like anybody is saying, oh, we've got to get Josh out, here's the biggest threat of the game, which is what everybody was doing with Arus. We had this whole plan concocted, or we've got to get Arus out, he's the threat of the game, this is how we're going to do it. Whereas we had no real suggestion that Arus had any numbers to fight against that. We knew who was going to betray him, and we didn't have any reason to believe he had a legitimate counterattack. He was just a sitting duck waiting to be picked off. And this time you think, well, okay, so Josh has got Reed. There's this whole pairs alliance thing. Jeremy's a single. He could, you know, how's this going to work out? But I think it's a case that Josh has got the connections. You know, he has this alliance with Baylor, which seems a bit tentative, but I think Baylor should be sticking to it because I don't know how many people actually like Baylor apart from Josh. Wes likes him. Alec likes him. Jeremy had a secret scene last week where he was saying how even he feels like he has a connection with Josh. I mean, Josh just seems to be this very charming person. And it's Reed who everyone seems to have doubts with. Reed doesn't seem to have successfully made the connections that Josh has. And I think also people are starting... The people on Hinayapu who are like Jeremy and Natalie are probably... And probably Missy too, are probably savvy enough to say that, okay, if everybody likes Josh, that makes him a threat. So I think there's going to be this case of, well, we didn't really feel safe with Reed anyway, and Josh is so popular and charming that he's going to be a threat. So I think that is where the whole Josh thing is going to implode, and a lot of it will be because nobody on Hunapu, who of course is the tribe with the numbers effectively, has any connections with Reed that make them want to trust him through to the end game.
Yeah, in the recap segment this week, I know they said Jeremy, Julie, and Natalie were worried about losing their ally Reed, to use Jeff's phrase. I'm not sure how confident they were in the first place that Reed was their ally, and it's interesting that they were able to frame it in those terms because it was so convincing, even given the little that we've seen of Reed, that he would be flaky and a possibility to flip.
Obviously Reed must have had some sort of alliance with Jeremy in that he went and told him about the idol. But they've never shown Jeremy making an alliance with Reed. I mean, Reed has said virtually nothing except to Jeff. We've seen Reed talk to Jeff more than anybody on his tribe, I think. So, that's frustrating me. I think the whole Reed thing, Reed being this sort of unknown quantity, has been the most frustrating thing for me trying to figure out what's going on this season. But one thing I noticed this week, when after Reed won the reward and Jeff says, oh, so who are you going to send? And obviously Natalie was going to volunteer, and Reed doesn't give her time because he straight away says Julie. Everybody else who has done the exile choice, they've always gone, oh, such a tough decision, you know. And Reed, he has it all planned out. He knew he was going to send Julie, which is good, but you want to at least pretend this is a tough decision for you. It's like, oh, I feel bad about it, but Julie, I'm going to send you. I want you to prove to John. And this, I think, is where Reed's game must be falling down. He knows what to do. He's a fan of the show, but he's not bringing that empathy, that feeling of sincerity with people.
Yeah, and he gives the most contrived, passive-aggressive reason possible for sending Julie. Like, you prove to John Rocker that you're actually worthy of being out here. Like,
nobody bought that. Nobody. Everybody knew why he was doing it.
And it's just such an underhanded way to do it, almost, where
I know
you don't need to do that. It's unnecessary. And
come on.
The only thing it accomplishes is making Julie feel bad about you and about herself, which is really not anything she needs at that point.
And, you know, Reed's the actor of the cast. He should be able to sell that.
Right, you know, yeah.
Make her feel that this is actually, in some way, a good thing.
Yeah, I agree with you that Reed's invisibility is the big variable this season, and I feel like it's actually a clue as to what's going to happen, because I feel like if Reed and Josh did go far together, I said a few weeks ago that maybe they would undersell Reed because, like, maybe he loses into the finals to Josh, and you want to explain why that happens, but I'm thinking more now that they don't show Reed because he's going to be gone soon, and they don't have a reason to show Reed. And same thing for Wes, and same thing for Alec, where if Josh somehow does win this showdown at the Merge, who is he going to be in the endgame with? It's Reed, who we haven't seen anything of, Alec, who has popped up here and there, but really hasn't given us too much to go on, and Wes, who has maybe been even more invisible than Reed has. And that's just not a recipe for compelling TV when you have only one person who you've even seen before, pretty much. Whereas if Jeremy's side wins, you have Jeremy, Julie, and Natalie, who the editors are taking pains to reinforce as a threesome. And then you have Keith, you have Missy and Baylor, who have been at the forefront of the show so far as well. So you can easily imagine in your mind how that might play out. Whereas with Josh, it's like you have Josh and then a bunch of chorus members, essentially, who really haven't done anything so far.
Well, to play devil's advocate, I could see Alec and Wes are people who I could see getting their storyline after the Merge. You know, we've seen plenty of times before where a player is invisible before the Merge, then they get their storyline. And I think if Josh does somehow manage to keep the power after the Merge, he'll be in with people like Keith, who have had the groundwork put in, and Baylor. I mean, the whole Baylor has been forced on us all season. So I don't think it's necessarily a death knell for Josh, but I would certainly agree with you that he is most likely going to be gone from our screens on Wednesday night.
Yeah, what was your take on Baylor? Because she's someone who, it seems like most of the fan base, like the casual fans and hardcore fans alike, have really risen up in reaction against. And I can see why, like, her own castmates seem to find her irritating as well. But I find it more hilarious than anything else.
I think my main fear with Baylor is that she'll win. Don't let this be the best way of giving Baylor a positive winner's edit. You know, she's a 20-year-old girl on Survivor to promote her music career. And I think the general assumption is that she and her mother are recruits, so whether Baylor's ever seen Survivor before, except for a couple of seasons before going out there, is up in the air. She's there to play. I'll give her that. You know, she and her mother are there to play. But it's like, what has Baylor done? She's got... There's no connections. The only person she seems to have any sort of connection with is Josh and her mother. You know, she antagonized Dale. Jacqueline, she said she had no working relationship with. Alec and she were squabbling like brother and sister. And then, I don't know, maybe she has a friendship with Wes. Who knows, because we don't see Wes either. And then, what a few people are starting to comment from this week is the way her nail polish is still perfect. And I was watching a secret scene, and I could see on the secret scene that she's got, like, the first couple of fingers on her hands, the nail polish, those, is completely gone. And on the remaining fingers, it's perfect. So it looks like the moment her nail polish chips, she just carefully scratches it all off rather than have scratch nail polish, but she's leaving the stuff on that's still polished. And what this says to me is she is not doing her share around camp. This is something that a woman is noticing. I'm sorry, all you male listeners out there. But she's not doing her share around camp, and the moment her nail polish gets chipped, which is just a terrible thing, she's just taking far too much care of it. And if that isn't driving her tribe mates crazy, I will be very, very surprised.
As somebody who, as you might imagine, knows very little about nail polish, what's actually going on there?
I don't know. I don't actually wear nail polish because it makes my fingers cold. This is a phenomenon that's apparently unique to me. Nobody understands what I mean by it. But, it's just a case of she wants to look pretty on television. So she wants to keep her... It's about the only bit of makeup you can sort of keep going for a while. But, yeah, I think she should get over it because it's not the image you want to portray on Survivor among your castmates.
Well, I do see what you mean about her being out there to promote her music career, but she doesn't strike you as a type to... Like, she's not the stereotypical, oh, I'm 21, I live in LA, and I'm out here because this is a springboard to me being in show business. Right? She's clearly got some kind of value to the show outside of that.
If you say so. I think, honestly, she's more... She's got a competitive streak in her. I think she does want to win. But I don't think... It's difficult to see what she is doing. I mean, she is trying to play, but it's difficult to see what she is doing that is advancing herself. And this sounds odd, but I think that she has not really had to face any adversity in the game, because although she was getting votes at all those early tribal councils, she always had somebody protecting her. And then her mother came into her tribe, and luckily for her, her mother had made friends with everybody in her dominant tribe, so she brought all those allies with her. And then, you know, Missy's Mama Bear side decided to take over and take out Dale and Kelly because Dale was being mean to her daughter, which seems a bizarre way of playing Survivor to me and a bizarre way of parenting to me. But there we go. So, sorry, I'm not, probably not going to win any friends by going on about Missy and Dale.
Sure.
They just bug me. But I will give them their props, though, because they're playing the game and they're doing well.
Yeah, I'll ask you about Missy a bit more in a second. As you say, Baylor's only friend seems to be Josh, and I think that's because Josh is a very diplomatic person. I'm not sure that even he really feels positively about Baylor.
No, I don't think he likes her, but yeah, he's a diplomatic person, and he knows she's a number, and she's probably a safe person to take to the end. And this is probably where my worry about Baylor winning is just I can't see who she would beat.
Yeah, I don't think that's something you have to be concerned about. I think
there's a lot left to play, but yeah.
I think the best word I've seen someone use to describe Baylor is grimy. Like, there's just something about her which just really alienates people and turns them off immediately. And it seems like every season there's one person where, if you look at the exit interviews done on their tribe, every single person has something bad to say about them. And Baylor fits into that role here. Like, Nadia has something bad to say about her, so did Val, so did Rocker. Kelly and Dell obviously weren't fans of her. The only pre-merge boot who hasn't mentioned Baylor so far is Drew, who obviously was never on a tribe with her. So... that doesn't bode that well for her going forward.
Yeah, I'm assuming she's going to be in for the game for a long time.
I think she is going to be one of those central characters post-merge where at some point, again, she is going to be the swing vote, or she and her mother are going to be the swing votes, and the whole season is going to come down to which way they go, and the people who are on the wrong end of that are going to be very much aggrieved by it, even more so than all the people that she's voted out already.
Yeah, and this is... I wonder how much this moment where... the Reed's choice at Exile and Natalie volunteering is actually going to dictate that. Now, I don't know what you thought of Natalie's decision. I thought it was great. Obviously transparent, but sometimes in Survivor, obviously transparent is a good thing. And Natalie's sort of basically declaration to Missy and Baylor is, I'm still here to look out for you. I still want to work with you. Might be what sort of tips the balance of the post-merge game and this whole pairs alliance thing, because suddenly Natalie isn't just a single who is a target, she is a number for Missy and Baylor, whereas Reed has just set himself up as somebody equally transparent who was trying to get rid of Julie, who was isolating her because saying, you're not in my numbers, I'm going to send you to Exile Island and let you miss out on the reward because I don't care about you. So I think it was something where, in some ways, I wonder if Reed should have, I don't think he could have knocked back Natalie's offer at that point, but he should have, it would have been better for him if she had been able to volunteer before he nominated Julie.
Yeah, it feels like if you're going to do something that transparent, it may as well be making friends instead of making enemies. Mm. As loath as I am to say it, I think Natalie is playing a fantastic game so far. And if you look at what might happen post-merge, she might be the most well-connected person and the person that brings it all together, because she has Jeremy and Julie with her on her tribe at the moment. Missy, in her secret scenes, just is glowing about Natalie, talks about how she's like a second daughter to her. And now she has that tie with Baylor as well. That's four people whose primary allegiance is to Natalie, and that's a very good prospect. And I know Missy and Keith apparently are very close as well, so if you bring in Keith, maybe you bring in Wes, that's at minimum five votes right there, and potentially, you know, seven, eight, or even more.
Yeah, the Wes obviously might want to go with Josh. We know Wes and Josh were tight, and Keith had that bonding time with Josh on Exile Island, not spooning, but bonding. So Wes and Keith are a bit question marks for me, and I think part of that will depend on how much did Keith know about the vote split this week.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big unanswered questions. I remember back in the teaser that they did at the end of the premiere, we had Jeff alluding to the fact that someone might be quitting. We also had Keith saying, like, I've done the worst thing in Survivor history or something, and also I'm glad he's gone. So I wonder if that relates to Wes in some way. Like, maybe Keith does something that forces Wes to quit, or maybe Keith and Wes are on opposite sides of that first vote, or something has to happen like that, because Wes, you can understand Wes being a fairly under-the-radar character. It's hard to understand him being a completely invisible character, and so that's why one of my pet theories at the moment is that Wes might be the quitter, if there is one. Like maybe that was Jeff and the editors throwing all of us off, and if so, then you have to tip your hat to them. But if there is a quitter, obviously the most likely candidate is Julie, but maybe there's another option there.
My hope is that this is a very faint hope, but my hope is that this is all a big troll, whereas Jeff comes out to Julie and goes, so are you officially quitting? And she goes, no, I just needed to vent, But I would love for that to happen, if this is all one massive troll. But I think it's much more likely that Julie is quitting. I don't see Wes being the quitter. He's a big, big fan of the show from everything we saw in the previews. Not in the previews, in the pre-season material. And he's, he's not complaining. I don't know if you watched, there's a secret scene this week where he goes out, he gets stung by a stingray or something, and he's just hopping calmly back up on the beach going, yeah, something got me. He does not strike me as the type to quit. A medevac, maybe, but then we would have seen that stingray thing in the episode instead of as a secret scene. So, no, I can't see Wes quitting. He's in for the long call. I mainly feel sorry for Wes because, he's sort of dragged his dad out here to play Survivor with him, and his dad's the one getting all the screen time.
Yeah, it has to be terrible as someone who is a fan like that to go out on Survivor, last for a fairly long time, and then wait for months and months to finally see yourself on TV, and then just there's nothing. I mean, you're basically written out of the cast.
Yeah, and it's going to be much worse when it's your dad, who is, I mean, I love Keith, but Keith is clearly the kind of casual fan who, at a moment when Eric Reichenbach is handing over his immunity necklace, Keith is probably going to go and get a beer from the fridge or something. he's not feeling Survivor the way most of us do. I'm sure before they went out there, Keith was going, it's going to be fine. It's not that hard. And Wes was going, Dad, you're going to be eaten alive. And Wes has probably fully expected Keith to be going home at any of these tribal councils that he's been to. And now we've got to this stage, and Keith is the bigger character of the two. And Keith, based on editing, Keith is the one with the shot to win here because Wes doesn't have a chance. And that's just, there's something so tragic about that.
There is. I don't think that Wes would take that as like an editor's choice between giving Keith airtime and giving Wes airtime. If anything, you'd expect Wes to get more airtime anyway, because at some point when Wes gets medevaced or quits or gets voted out, whatever fate happens to before him, we're going to have some kind of confessional from Keith talking about how sad he is, how choked up he is, and how he needs to soldier on and move forward. And that's going to have so much less emotional impact, precisely because we haven't been led to care about who Wes is at all.
And Wes was one of my favourites in the pre-season stuff. I like both Wes and Keith, so yeah. Again, like with Reed, I'm really disappointed we haven't seen more of Wes. We're seeing, if this has been the season of the casual fans, we've seen the recruits and the people who just don't know Survivor very well, and very little from the people who do.
Yeah, Wes is like this adorable little gremlin who, I'd love it if he was just like this under-the-radar fun presence, but instead they've just vanished him into thin air. And I think in a Blood versus Water season, it's even more important that you have some kind of even distribution of airtime, because in a normal season, you can kind of isolate someone and not really give them any kind of treatment at all. And then if that person doesn't have any relationships, that kind of makes sense and that doesn't affect the story at all. Whereas here, every single person has at least one strong tie that is going to be cared about by that person and maybe by other people, and you really can't give a full account of that in the story unless you build them up in their own right.
So things aren't looking good for Wes, but I hope he at least gets a bit of storyline after the merge. So
Sure. So I said about 10 minutes ago that we would circle back around to Missy at some point. You
Oh,
said
yeah.
that your dislike of Baylor extends to her mother as well. Why is that? Because, well, I guess I can see why that is, but I think Missy, even though one might not dislike her, you have to respect the game that she's playing at the moment, where for as many enemies as her daughter's making, Missy's making that many friends and might be the one who is bailing Baylor out as a player in the game.
Oh, I think Missy is arguably playing the best social game out there. And you know, I always tend to root for the older women, so it's unusual for me to take against one. There's just something about Missy which rubs me up the wrong way. So it's, I don't know, but she's playing a solid game. She, again, I'm assuming she's a recruit, not seen much Survivor, so I don't think she's got the sort of the knowledge base to really be planning ahead. But just from common sense, she knows you want to have friends. And I think a lot of the background to the Dale and Kelly vote was like, well, if Dale wanted Baylor out, he's not going to be an ally, so let's get both of these people out. Apparently, Kelly never bonded well with her. But she did have bonds, which doesn't seem to be true of people like Jeremy, who are fans of the show. She did have bonds with the outsiders. She obviously had bonds with John, and apparently Drew liked her as well. And I don't, I mean, Jeremy did an interview with Entertainment Weekly this week, which is sort of a mid-game thing, where we're going to hear so many different versions of this, but his blame for the Rice story was he was listing the people who were eating, and he had Reed quite high up. So I imagine Missy's rice-giving policy went down very well with Reed, and I don't know how much she's been taking this way to a man's heart through his stomach, literally, but it seems she has been going out of her way, whether with rice or with just being there for people. She is being there for people. She's trying to play the mother hen role, so to speak, and it's worked for her, and good for her.
Yeah, I think the older women on Survivor really have been doing a good job recently. I see what you mean about Missy, though, where she does seem faintly irritating, but she doesn't have the same kind of sheer destructive capacity that someone like Cass had, where you could at least sit back and revel in the carnage that they were creating.
And Cass was funny too. That was
Sure.
the thing. Cass and I must have a very similar sense of humor. I thought she was hysterical. Yeah, and I think also there's, it's probably because she's a casual fan. You're just not going to get that sort of level of talking about the game, that sort of insight to the game, which is what I like to look for. And you often see that in the older women. For some reason, they seem to tend to be better observers. Or maybe it's just because I find it easier just to understand their point of view. But I usually like hearing the old women in confessional, watching their secret scenes. And Missy just isn't giving me anything. She's not sort of looking in the game the way I would. But she's doing what she needs to do. She's still there, and she is in one of the strongest positions for the post-merge game. And it'll be interesting to see how she manages to drag her daughter forward, because that's the main thing about Missy, is that her game is very much focused around her daughter and getting her daughter forward. And I don't know how she'd be doing if it was her, if she was there on her own. I suspect she wouldn't be there if she was there on her own, but yeah, it's all very much, I don't think we're going to see a mother-daughter vote off this season, but I think she is going to go haywire if Baylor goes out before she does.
Yeah, Missy is someone who I think might be a better player or a more successful player if Baylor weren't there with her, dragging her down, but also would be a less interesting player because one of the main reasons that that relationship is compelling is precisely because the two of them are there together and they're going to influence each other's fates in a big way. One incidental victim of all of this Baylor hate has been Sierra because we and others were making these comparisons weeks ago about how they seem to be consciously trying to recreate the Laura and Sierra dynamic with the two of them. Sierra seemed to take offense to this and had a tweet recently where she said, quote, "I keep hearing the Baylor comparison. I don't see it. She's a daughter and I'm a daughter," which is a fair point. But then, as people on Twitter do, there were 20 or 25 replies to that all saying, "Oh no, of course it's wrong because Baylor's awful and you're amazing." And she went down and favorited every single one of them, which is better than retweeting them, I suppose, for those of us who follow her, but you can kind of see why she was a little upset about that. Moving on to a few other players then, what's your take on Jeremy? Because Jeremy is being set up as this foil to Josh, or maybe vice versa, and every piece of action in the past few episodes at that camp has been filtered through Jeremy. We always hear his thoughts on it, and the moment we hear anybody else's thoughts, it's always followed by Jeremy explaining why he thinks they're an idiot. And I don't know, I feel like I'm usually drawn to that kind of archetype of the confident leader who's in control and delivers his verdict on everyone else, but I'm really not buying or liking Jeremy this season.
Well, I think it's the point where we apologize to any Jeremy fans out there, because I know I'm pretty much the same opinion as you. It's just he's too negative. And it was actually, and I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for this, but it's actually the reason I didn't like Spencer, certainly in the later stages of last season, because he just seemed so negative all the time. And certainly Jeremy is in a different degree of negativity than Spencer was. And Spencer, you know, is great when he's commentating on Survivor. So it's not exactly the same thing, but yeah, I don't like it when people just sit around complaining that nobody else is playing the game well.
Yeah, you know? And I remember when we saw those bios for Spencer pre-season, people's concern was that if Spencer was ever in a position of power, then that's the kind of attitude that he would have, that he would be lording it over everyone, talking about how stupid they are and how he's a superior player. Turns out he was never in a position of power at any point, but so he wasn't able to do that. But I feel like we're getting to see in Jeremy that kind of reaction being played out, where Jeremy knows that he's in control and he needs everybody else who's watching to know that as well.
Yeah, and, you know, give Spencer his due. He had things to complain about. Jeremy, yeah, right. Not so much. It's like, give these people a break, Jeremy. Yeah. You've got to, I mean, and not so much because they deserve it, but because if you are complaining about them all the time, they're going to know. Then you're not going to be able to be sincere unless you are finding that place of empathy to come from. And that's going to come across in your relationships with them.
Quite. There are some people who are able to talk crap about people to the cameras and then put on a mask and go out and be perfectly sincere to them to their faces. I don't think that Jeremy has that ability to make that distinction. I feel like Jeremy's confessionals are coming from the same place as his relationships with the other people, and that some of that is going to bleed through to them.
And I will say that far fewer people have that ability than most people than I actually believe they do. And than you would believe necessarily from editing. I mean, so taking a comparison, you've got Tyson and Monica, whereas Tyson was occasionally going to make comments about Monica in confessional, but at the same time, he did have a genuine fondness for her. It was just, you know, being Tyson in his confessionals. And that's what you need. If you don't have that genuine fondness for a person, if you can't find some place in which you can make a real connection with them, it's going to be very hard to convince them that, oh, yes, I do like you.
So, and also, Tyson had that kind of biting sarcasm in his sense of humor, and everybody knew that, to where you knew that Tyson would be saying these things about everybody, including you, whether it's to your face or to the cameras. And I feel like that was actually a really big benefit for Tyson, where he could say things which, coming from anybody else, would sound like insults or sound arrogant, and which coming from him maybe were actually meant that way, but because people thought they understood his sense of humor, you know, they thought, oh, that's just Tyson being Tyson, you know, he's just joking around, whereas Jeremy doesn't have that crutch to fall back on.
And it is one of those cases that, I know it's heresy on this podcast, but it's one of the reasons Sandra's games works so well, because she was outspoken, people knew that she would mouth off, and that was just who she was, and that's what they liked her for, and they knew that it didn't mean she didn't like them.
I will give Sandra credit for that. That is the one thing that I think she can be credited for. Like, you know where you stand with Sandra, or at least you think you know where you stand, and so if that doesn't match up with where you actually do stand with her, then she has that advantage over you, yeah.
Okay, and just to represent Colin on here, stop talking about Sandra, move on. Jeremy, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, we don't really see Jeremy interacting. We don't really see people just talking on Hunapu, probably because they haven't been going to tribal council so much. But we hear a lot more from Jeremy talking to the camera than we do with him. We saw him, you know, trying to comfort Julie. And I don't know how effective a job he was doing or how effective a job he could have done. But we we don't know. I mean, who does he definitely like? He obviously gets on really well with Natalie. One thing about Jeremy is he is a twin. He has a twin brother. So mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of where his bond with Natalie is coming from. But yeah, I don't get any sort of real bond that Jeremy has with anybody else. Whereas, you know, even someone like Josh, who we mentioned, he's got, we know that everybody really loves him. Who really loves Jeremy? And that's one of the hard things with Jeremy. He just seems to be this grumpy guy who's sitting about moping, not really able to play the game because he's not going to tribal council. And so he's just sitting there making grumbly comments about everybody that aren't even funny. And we don't know who likes him, but we do know that he has a lot of allies and a lot of influence, and he does get to talk about the game, and we ask, and the game, a lot of these things that are happening at Hunapu are presented from his point of view. So he's supposed to be the character we have an investment in. It's just, I'm finding it very difficult to have an investment in Jeremy, aside from the fact that I picked him to win preseason, so go Jeremy.
Sure. Yeah, I think he would be more endearing if he was able to poke fun at himself or to show some kind of empathy for what other people are going through as he makes fun of them. Whereas instead, it comes across like he thinks he's this cyborg who would never ever feel hungry on Survivor or, you know, stuff like that, where clearly this is meant to be a difficult experience, and maybe Julie is overreacting in some sense, but you know that this is going to happen to people, and part of the advantage that a player like Jeremy has is being able to maintain his composure while other people react like that. So, you know, he can't really have it both ways, but he's getting angry at it as he benefits from it. Like you say, though, he does have this good relationship with Natalie. I think he puts in the effort with Julie because he knows that she is his meal ticket, right? Where if she makes it to the final three, she's probably not getting any votes at this rate. Although I'm not quite sure how many votes Jeremy would get either. Like because the usual debate is, will this person be respected for their game, or will the jury be angry at them? I could see the jury recognizing that Jeremy has been, quote-unquote, in control, whatever that means, but also disliking him enough that they give the money to Natalie, which is not something I ever thought I would be able to say preseason, but here we are. It's actually looking fairly realistic now.
All right, well, actually, a little bit on Natalie's. And I don't know how much you've watched The Amazing Race. I know for the season, the first season she was on, like Colin, I watched that first episode of the season and thought, oh my gosh, these are horrible people, get them off my screen. Unlike Colin, I carried on watching. And, you know, by the end of the season, you get used to the Twinnies and you actually really, I really like them. Obviously, I'm a Twinnies fan. And they were very popular among their cast. There were a couple of people who didn't like them, but even then, I think there was a team called Ryan and Abby, and I know now Ryan's really good friends with them. So they are these likable people. They're obnoxious, but they are likable. So I fully believe Natalie, if she gets to the end, she could win, even if she gives a really bizarre speech calling the jury bloody fools. But I think she could still win because that's what the jury will expect of her. But the thing with Natalie is I do think there's a very good risk she will be voted out before then because people will realize she is too much of a threat. She's too likable. With Jeremy, it is hard to see at the moment what the case is, but I think he's got the alpha male bump, we'll say, whereas he's the kind of guy who you expect to be leading the alliance. And the fact that, unlike Drew and Josh, who are plainly sort of out of the loop, he was able to be in a good position. He had all these alliances with the girls, so he can point to that. There's still the merge game left to play. One of the biggest things that confused me about Jeremy is how he didn't get the idol.
Even more so than that, how did Keith end up with it? Like, you could understand if the second person who went to exile was someone who fits a profile of someone who might find it, but if you had said in the first episode, Jeremy and Keith will both get a clue and Keith will be the one who finds it, I'm not sure anyone would have laid you money on that.
No, I don't understand. I mean, I appreciate you don't want to be obviously searching, but John Rocker obviously found that idol pretty readily with the clue that Jeremy had. And Jeremy had two days or three days? But, you know, certainly I would have thought that once Keith went to exile and Jeremy thought, okay, I've got a pretty good clue. Keith's going to get an even better clue. Let me go and find it before he gets back. And I don't know whether he searched and just didn't find it and we didn't see it because of that, but as far as we know, nothing. And as far as we know, he didn't even talk to Keith when he got back saying, hey, look about that clue. You know, do you want to go together on this? So Keith goes searching for it, assumes Jeremy has it when he doesn't find it after half an hour. But then not only that, Keith then says, well, let's go back and look again. You know, he doesn't give up, whereas we don't see Jeremy searching at all. So that is just so bizarre to me. It's one of the reasons I'm struggling to like Jeremy as a player. You know, how is it that, say what you will about Keith, but at least he put in that effort. He went back. He's playing the game in his own fashion. I love Keith.
I love Keith too.
Also didn't like the way he reacted so strongly to Keith's accusations, because again, why didn't you say to Keith when he came back from, it's a bit late to go to him after he says, oh, I think Jeremy has the idol, to start yelling at him for that. You should have made your preemptive strike. You should have been talking to him and suggesting this alliance before he even had chance to go and look for the idol.
I think it's emblematic of a wider failure in Jeremy's game, where he seems not able to keep allies close to him, where obviously we see this with Keith, but also on that first Hunapu vote, you know that maybe there's going to be a swap soon and you need to keep people tightly reined in. But instead, you have votes flying off in four different directions. You have half the tribe not knowing anything that's going on. And so all of those people potentially are minded to turn against Jeremy at a merge. And the only thing that might be keeping them from doing that is other people in Jeremy's alliance exerting influence on his behalf. So it's not even like he's rescuing himself from his own mistakes in the way that someone like Tony did.
Yeah, I really didn't like how he handled that tribal council, because that was when he decided to have his showdown with Keith, which seems really bizarre. And of course, that's John got really confused and ended up voting for Keith, apparently on the strength of what was happening at tribal council. So yeah, it was a little weird first that nobody sort of told Reed and Keith and John what was up, and I don't know. But Jeremy's whole position is that just feels a little bit on the edges. And I think there's plenty of time for him to turn it around after the merge. I think the way forward, if we assume Julie quits, which may not happen, but I think the way forward is that Keith and Natalie need to sell themselves as a pair. They are the twins, the new twinnies team. And then they can advertise themselves to John and Jacqueline and Baylor and Missy, and that's how they get Josh and Reed out, and then they can slowly work on breaking up the real pairs.
Yeah, I think John is the perfect example of what you're saying, where at that tribal council, he clearly just wanted to be a part of something that was going on, and if anybody had just whispered in his ear and told him who to vote for, he would have been fine with that. Instead, he's left out of the loop, he casts a stray vote, and then after the swap, he's in a position of power now, and going into the merge, he might be in another one again. And possible evidence for that is we saw John saying, Jacqueline and I are the swing votes again. And as he was saying that, Jeff Bittman pointed this out on Twitter, he was wearing a post-merge buff that had been doctored to look like it was from the pre-merge. So that confessional has to reference something that's about to happen. And it could be at the merge, you have Josh appealing to him on one side, Jeremy appealing to him on the other. If Jeremy had just kept him a little bit closer beforehand, that wouldn't even be a debate in his mind.
Yeah, well, that's true, though. I would say I'm not placing too much merit on this sort of post-merge confessional, just because I'm not sure I trust John to be a good monitor of the game. I don't think he's necessarily got the right take on things. So he may think he's a swing vote when he's actually about to get blindsided. But yeah, I know what you mean. He has to be in a position where he thinks he needs to be a swing vote. And that's...
What's your take on John? Because pre-season, I thought he was just like part of this generic couple who they found because they didn't really have anyone more interesting. But after these first few episodes, I'm really growing to love John. And I kind of like Jacqueline as well, but I feel like she's many interesting insofar as she relates to John and his kind of besottedness with her.
they're just the generic beautiful couple, and I like them because they are playing, they want to play, they don't know what they're doing, but they're here to play. And they seem like nice people. I don't really give them, I think they're going to be caught up in everybody's schemes and ultimately cast by the wayside when people are done with them, because nobody wants to let that sort of couple get to the end. But yeah, I like them. I don't think I really have much to say about them more than that. I wish them very well in life, and I hope they both get far so that they can afford this surrogate mother for their children.
I also enjoyed Baylor's fascination with them, because coming from her own experiences where her mother's been divorced 3 times, and now she gets out there and she sees this fairy tale romance developing right before her eyes. I mean, I have no idea what that does to her perception of love and marriage.
I hadn't thought about that, but yes. I mean, they weren't even engaged at that point, were John and Jacqueline? They just got engaged, so yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right.
This is what a normal relationship looks like. Although we shouldn't say that, because I mean, obviously Missy is good enough socially that she's 3 times convinced somebody to marry her when they obviously shouldn't have done. So
that's one way of looking at it, I suppose. As you say, John and Jacqueline are going to be targets post-match at some point. Bring that back to Natalie. I think that's actually one reason why, despite her being well-liked, she's not going to be a target, because there are so many couples in the game who are much more obvious threats, where she can point to them and say, okay, these two need to be split up, these two need to be split up. Once you've done that, you have these angry singles who are on the outs, who are going to be mad at the people who just voted out their loved ones, and so they have to be dealt with now as well. And so you have, you know, 4, 5, maybe 6 people who need to be cut down immediately. And once the dust clears from that, you have Natalie in a great position to win, and only a few people that she has to get through to reach that point.
Are you actually rooting for Natalie to win at this point?
Don't put me on the spot like that.
This is actually my dream. This is my dream for the podcast, is for Natalie to win, both because I think you had her in your draft, didn't you? So you would
She and Nadia were the last two picks, and I picked Natalie because, hey, why not? And then if she goes on to win, that would be the second season in a row where my default pick ends up winning over Colin, which would be fantastic.
That would be fantastic. Plus, it means that both you and Colin have to live in a world where a Twinny won Survivor. So, yeah, this is my dream, a Natalie victory. But I don't think it's going to happen. But, you know.
You don't? Because I actually think it's the most likely outcome now.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, this is great. I'm all for
horrifying.
This.
Horrifying. But, yeah, and in addition to that, I think partially for the same reasons that Colin and I never had her on our radar, I think the idea of a Twinny being likable when you know their history, unless you followed The Amazing Race extensively and you know that actually they're both friends with all of their castmates now, the idea of her being likable just doesn't really occur to you, I don't think, if you know their history. And so it's easy for you to underestimate her and think, well, clearly I'm not going to lose to a Twinny. And you've seen how abrasive they can be, and they can get into fights with people and with each other. So that idea of her just giving this great jury speech or anything doesn't really occur to you. I also think the two of them apart obviously are much more individually bearable than the two of them together, for reasons that should go without saying.
One of the things I was most disappointed about this episode was that Nadia was not there to be doing this puzzle that Josh and Reed were doing, because I would have loved, because Natalie was doing this really restrained, encouraging cheering, and if Nadia had been there, it would have been, you fool, get a move on, we are losing, come on.
Yeah. Nadia being the first one voted out might be the best thing that happens to Natalie in the game, in my view, because there's just no possibility of them reuniting and them being lumped together in that way.
Mm. They would have been, I think, a huge target if they were still together, because they obviously do have this really, I think even for twins, unusually close relationship. So I think Natalie had a secret scene this week where she was saying, you know, whichever of us wins the money, it goes into both of our pockets, which is not something you'd expect from 28-year-old siblings.
Right.
So, they are in many ways as tight as a married couple. And I think, and they're obviously both very good physically. They are both smart. People like to say they're stupid, but they're not. They are more intelligent than you think. So, I think they would have been huge threats if they were both still together. So it's unfortunate for Nadia to go out first, but it's also traditional for the Twinnies to have a really bad first episode.
Sure.
I kind of want Natalie to go out fourth, just that they mirror their two amazing race finishes. But I would be over the moon if Natalie won. My actually main concern against it is that I think she's not got the edit for it, because she's made, you know, you can't say that she's played what the producers like to say is that, oh, sometimes women play this more passive game, more behind the scenes. Whereas Natalie, I think, has been out there and she has been making her own moves. But those moves we still see through Jeremy's perspective, some of those moves, like the true vote.
With the exception of this episode, where the Baylor thing, I think, is a big call in her favour, where she makes this move to form a tie with Baylor, and then she gets a confessional clearly explaining in detail why she felt she needed to do that. And if we see that pattern being repeated in future episodes, then that, you know, that's a really good sign for her, I think.
Yeah, that I hope that happens. I'm still worried she was just portrayed too much as a secondary character in the previous episodes. But the other thing that I could see happening, and I really, really hope it doesn't, is that she becomes a third with Baylor and Missy, and then what happens is it turns out to be a final two, and somehow Baylor or Missy meet her in the
That would be perfect. I would love that. The internet would explode. It would be, oh, glory.
Oh, it would be horrendous. I would just be in, this would be worse than when Ceri went out in Micronesia.
Well, if you think back to the sheer dread that the fan base showed last season at the idea of Cass and Wu being in the final two together, if you could find some way to repeat that, that would be fantastic.
Oh, I would have loved that. A Cass and Wu, even if it meant a Wu win, it would have been amazing. Cass and Tony was, of course, what I was dreaming for, but that was never going to happen.
Sure. Coming back to Nadia quickly, when I was watching their first season of The Amazing Race, they kind of blended together in my mind, and they were just like this awful two-headed terror, and it was hard to distinguish between them to any great degree. But I get the sense that Natalie is maybe the more sensible one of the two, and so it's not it's not a surprise that she's the one doing well, and if you had swapped her with Nadia, you maybe wouldn't have got the same outcome.
I can't really speak for the Amazing Race because I am useless at telling Amazing Race contestants apart. So when you get two people as similar as Natalie and Nadia, I had no idea which one was which until Survivor, when they helpfully, you know, Natalie dyed her hair and Nadia shaved hers. I don't know, because I think Nadia really went out because of the Amazing Race thing. Dale's made it clear in his interviews that that's why he targeted her, and good for him for doing it, because, you know, you have to throw somebody under the bus. And I don't think there was anything she could really have done to save herself. I don't think Natalie would have improved on that. I will say, watching their pre-season material, I got the impression that Natalie was a little more into Survivor and an individual game than Nadia was. So I'm glad of the two, it was Nadia who drew the short straw. But I don't think I could definitively say that Nadia would be doing worse than Natalie if she was still in it.
Sure. And I guess there is a concern that maybe if somebody does something that she doesn't like, then she's going to blow up on them. But we've only seen that once so far with John Rocker, and it took a very unique set of circumstances for that to take place, and you're not going to have anyone antagonize her to the same degree, I don't think.
Yeah, well, she's not going to lose her loved one again, is she?
No.
I don't think, I mean, I'm sure she will blow up at people, but I don't think in a way that they don't expect her to. It goes back to, you know, the Sandra and Tyson kind of thing, where, you know, the players know that's the personality she is. It's a bit different when somebody who has always been sweetness and light to you suddenly starts screaming at you, you know. So, I mean, there is, I could certainly see a scenario where she says too much because she's not subtle. That's not their game. But, you know, the thing about Survivor is you have to play the game that suits your strengths. You know, playing the subtle, sneaky game is perhaps the ideal, but not for everybody, and that's not the game Natalie can play. It's not the game she is playing. And again, if you look at Reed as the inverse of that, he's trying to play the subtle, sneaky game, and it's not working out too well for him, as far as we can tell. I could be wrong. So, yeah, I think Natalie is probably the biggest benefit she's got from The Amazing Race is knowing her strengths. She's somebody who's used to being in a competition, and she is playing the game that suits her strengths.
You mentioned Dale in there. Obviously, we see him go out this episode. What was your take on him? He definitely had this old man yells at cloud vibe about him, but by the same token, he was playing hard the whole way through, and even though he was on the outs from the first episode, he still managed to survive, what was it, 4 tribal councils, and he seemed to be making a decent case for himself every step of the way. So any parting thoughts on him at all?
Yeah, I want to say I thought Dale was going to be the first one off his tribe, and I thought he was actually a fantastic player, possibly one of the best of the season when you consider his handicaps. At first, I think, was he the oldest person? He was certainly, you know, decades above most people in his tribe. And he, as he knew going into the game, he did not have the social strengths you need for Survivor. So you look at what he did the first episode. He laid all the groundwork he could to maximize his chances. He threw Nadia under the bus. He started saying, you know, she's a threat. I saw the amazing race. You don't want to trust her. He sneaked something off to use potentially as an immunity, fake immunity idol down the road. He had brought his reading glasses with him just so that he could make a fire without flint. You know, he didn't need them. He brought them on purpose just for that. And that is exactly what you want people to do, is you want to go into the game having assessed your weaknesses and your strengths, and you're there making your case from day one. And it wasn't enough to get him to the merge, but, you know, he lasted a lot longer than somebody with his resources should have done. And I give him full credit for that. I really like Dale.
Yeah, I don't think I would say that he was a good player, but given the hand he was dealt and just who he is and the tribe that he had with him, I'm not sure there's much more he could have done, really.
I would say I really, really liked his move with John this week to offer him the immunity idol, because, you know, you can't really say you've got an idol when you haven't, because that's not... he knew they could split the votes. It wasn't even as if a case he could vote for Keith and save himself that way, because it would just tie it up and he'd be out on the re-vote. I think he got it worded wrongly, because he was saying to John, like, I will give you the idol because I just want to make it to the merge. And that's wrong, because if you just wanted to make it to the merge, you would play the idol. But he could have spun it like, you know, he should have said, I don't want to just make it to the merge. I want to, you know, have a chance in this game. I want to build an alliance with you. And it was what Marty did with Sash in Nicaragua, wasn't it? Where he said, if you keep me around this tribal council, I will give you the idol. And he should have said that, if you sent me home, fine, but if you don't, you'll be getting the idol.
Tried
to spin it that way, which it probably still wouldn't have worked, but I think it would be a slightly better way of doing it. And
yeah, I've seen lots of criticism for that move, but I think you're right. Like, he's almost certainly going home either way, but if he just plays his imaginary idol, or if he holds that threat over John's head, then even if he survives that week, he's not going to have any allies going forward. Whereas if he makes his promise, then maybe John buys it and you can parlay that into something. It's not going to work, most likely, but you have to at least take a shot. And yeah, I feel like that's what Dale did.
Yeah.
Let's talk about... who else have we not got to yet? Let's talk about Julie. There was always this question in my mind pre-season of, I'm not going to be able to evaluate her objectively or go into there without any preconceptions, because I know that she's tied to John Rocker and it's impossible to take those blinders off. Given that, you know, maybe I should be thinking about her in a different way, but I don't really have a strong opinion on her. Like, she's remarkably kind of normal and inoffensive for someone who is hooked up with this, you know, this controversial figure.
Yeah, it's weird, because obviously we had this episode here where she was not doing well, and there's a very strong likelihood she's going to be quitting in the next episode. But at the same time, I'm impressed with Julie, because she's not somebody who on paper I thought I was going to like, you know, a spray tan entrepreneur, not really the kind of female figure I'm looking for on Survivor. But she, you know, she was there to play. Maybe it was really for the fame of it more than anything else. But I really liked the way she sort of dealt with the John Rocker thing. I wouldn't say it was perfect, but, you know, she didn't try and make it personal. She was still trying to work with her tribe and fight for her own game. I thought she handled that very well. The cold thing, you know, I didn't like being cold either, so I can't definitively say I would have handled that any better. Thank God she didn't go to Exile Island. Do you think we'd have seen a double quit if she and Baylor had been on Exile Island?
I think Baylor could drive anyone into quitting, to be honest. So, yeah, it's definitely a possibility.
I just can't imagine that if Julie had gone. I could see Julie leaving Exile Island, and then would Bela have survived out there on her own?
I'm not sure. I think my dream season in terms of drama and controversy, it wouldn't involve people like Philip Shepherd or anyone like that. It would be you get all of these seemingly over-offensive young women like Bela, Eliza, RC, Alina, and you just drop them on an island together, and they would have this passive-aggressive death match for 39 days, and it would be fantastic television.
Oh, I might skip that season. I can see your point, but I think I would just be... I would be imploding every week.
Sure. Now that we're on the subject, actually, and I know you don't want to dwell on this, because that debate's kind of played out by now, what was your take on the John Rocker casting? Because that was really one of the big talking points of the first few episodes.
Yeah, for me, it was a case of... I can see why they did it, big character, oh yeah, he's going to be outspoken and cause fights. But the truth was, he wasn't really very outspoken and causing fights. What happened was that these, by coincidence really, the first two people of his tribe happened to be minority women, and Hunapu drew their own perfectly logical conclusions from that, and then that all imploded. And so suddenly you ended up with this big, not really attractive fight that wasn't actually anything to do with the game. And for me, it got in the way of the organic flow of the story, because you had to know about this article, this background history to him, but to understand why the big fuss was. And yeah, it just didn't work for me. If he was picked there to be a slightly dopey character, which was the character he was, then yes, that would have been fine, but it wasn't. It became about this article, which really had nothing to do with the game. I didn't like it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate when something external like that ends up playing into how the game works out, because it doesn't feed into an organic season like you would want. At the same time, though, that's kind of inevitable when you choose John Rocker to be out there, as opposed to the hundreds of other pro athletes that you could choose from, most of whom have been through the audition process already, yes. I imagine. Yes. So this was always going to happen, and it was always going to end this way, I think. Like, maybe their dream was to have John Rocker somehow be dragged along as a goat for 39 days, and he would just leave this trail of destruction in his wake. But realistically, some people were going to know who he was, they're going to take offense to him, he would get into some big unnecessary argument, and then he would go home. And I don't think you can really bank on too much more from that. And it's a depressing sign for the quality of their season in their own minds that they felt they had to do that. And I think if we do look back on the season fondly in a year's time, it won't be because of the three episodes that John Rocker was on. It will be because of stuff that the other normal cast members were able to do by themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I think CBS just they cast him. It's like recasting Brandon Hance. You know, they cast him in the hopes that something like this scene would happen. And I didn't like Jeff's sort of interview with Entertainment Weekly later saying that, oh, that wasn't, you know, we can't control that. That's just how things go sometimes. It's like, no, you knew when you were casting John Rocker that this kind of scene was likely to happen. And it's stunt casting, I think, in the ugliest sense. And I was just glad it's all over and done with. So,
one episode specific thing that I want to talk about quickly is this ultimatum that Jeff gives them, where they need more food, and Jeff promises that they're going to get a steep rise in return. And we have this dramatic pantomime music and all these reactions, and it turns out to be their camp is being stripped, which is obviously an uncomfortable situation for a few days. But it is only a few days, because the merge is coming soon, and so that takes a lot of the weight out of it, I think. Where it's like, it's not as though this is some permanent penalty which is going to last with you throughout the entire game. It's 3 or 4 days of added discomfort, and then it's all back to normal. And maybe at the merge, if the other tribe has to come to that camp and they find that it's all been torn down, then maybe that's a point of concern. But that would only be a thing for maybe 2 minutes of the merge episode, and then no one will care about it again. So, I don't know. This felt like they didn't have enough content for the episode, and they needed to fill it out somehow, and this is what they settled on to do that.
Yeah, and I know lots of people speculated that now, really, the precedent set here is eat your rice, because you can get it back for generally fairly little. I know they did have the rainstorm afterwards, which I'm sure production knew about. But at the same time, it's, yeah, you are nullifying your advantage, the advantage you gained over the other camp, by putting you back to the level of the other camp, really.
Yeah.
And I think there are two ways. I don't like, a lot of people said, you should have voted off a member. I don't like that idea either. I don't like adding an extra tribal council. I think the two ways Jeff could have gone here was either flat out say no and discreetly give everybody an extra bag of rice at the merge, or, because I think you do have to feed them. You don't want them to just pass out and go boring with, because they're too hungry to do anything. Or you say, okay, well, I'm going to give both camps a bag of rice, but all your luxury items are now going to go to the other camp.
What about a human sacrifice? That would have been fun TV.
That depends who's going to be sacrificed, though. I don't want to take that risk.
Maybe like Wes or Reed, and then we wouldn't have a reason to care about them because, you know, they end up being sacrificed for the greater good, you might say.
Okay. Well, yeah, we could do a human sacrifice. I think I'm happier not adding that sort of stunt sort of performance in as well. Let's just get back to Survivor.
Yeah, I feel like there's always been that tacit understanding that they're not going to let you starve. And so even if some members of your tribe are eating far too much rice or whatever else, they're not just going to let you be punished for that. If you're someone who, you know, was having proper portions or anything like that, they're not going to make you actually be in danger or anybody else, because I mean, that creates a whole host of thorny legal issues for a start. So yeah. I don't know whether that's you get slipped extra food and they just never show it and you're highly encouraged never to talk about it, or I don't know how they would do that, but I feel like this was a TV-friendly way of resolving that dispute and therefore they showed it, but in reality it was always going to be resolved one way or the other.
Yeah, I think the precedent is that they have used merges or tribal swaps as a convenient way, excuses to, oh, and here's an extra bag of rice, I think. From what I've heard from other survivors talking about it is that production usually do it sort of more discreetly than that, not actually slipping you extra food on the side, but, you know, coming up with some sort of convenient excuse to replace it. And I think, I don't know why they went this route with trying to get this very TV-friendly thing. I wonder if production just already worried about the content they're getting and thinking, oh, we've got to find something to put in the episode, so let's do this whole thing. But I kind of felt like it was a sort of a misfire and they'd have been better just not making it the issue it was. It just raises questions like, of not so much the integrity of the show, but why? What is the point? What is the point of saving your rice, and who cares about that deal?
Yeah, there's this awkward conundrum there where, given that the players know that there's this barrier that the producers won't let them go past, where they're not going to put you in any actual physical danger, then how far can you push that? Can you just eat your rice immediately and then say to them, look, if you don't give us anything, we're going to starve, and then so you have like an obligation or a duty to replenish that? Like, how far can you really push it if you're a contestant?
Yeah, I mean, certainly based on this season, if I was on a season of Survivor, which thank God I never can be, I would, for starters, I would not be the person saying how we're going to ration out the rice, but I would support anybody who wanted to eat all the rice because, you know, what's the penalty you're going to get? And what happens now if somebody does that who has not won any luxury items? What are they going to take away? You know, that. It's, yeah, I just think they're setting themselves up with a very bad precedent going forward, and I can see this backfiring on them, and I'm not really sure I want to see this becoming a running theme in subsequent seasons, like, oh, how are we going to get more rice, you know?
Yeah, I guess my point is, I feel like it's always been an undercurrent that's been there, and it just happens to be featured this season, maybe because there isn't anything else to feature, really. But I think it's always going to be an issue when you adhere to this premise of the show that they're in these very rough conditions and, you know, they're struggling against the elements. Eventually, if that struggle becomes too much or if they just don't have the means to do it, then you're going to have to aid them with something. And maybe that's rice, maybe it's giving them a tarp, maybe it's anything else. But you're always going to have that issue there for production. There's always going to be that kind of moral hazard.
I think I just like the more background setup where they find some occasion to give them the opportunity to get it as opposed to doing this whole deal thing. This deal thing felt like much more of an experiment, which for me didn't work out.
Sure. So going back to my girl Natalie for a moment, another reason that I think she's well placed to go on and win is, and I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on this. It feels very much to me like this season is set up to have a female winner. And I say that because we have these frequent allusions to gender, like, oh, John, you're throwing like a girl, or I would hit you if you weren't a girl, stuff like that. And whenever that's being said, it's always being said by a man, first of all, and it's always reflecting badly on them. And I feel like there are other just like throwaway quotes maybe throughout the season as well that all hint towards the same conclusion. So are you picking up on that same vibe?
Not until you brought it up, but now that you've mentioned it, that has happened a lot, hasn't it? Wow, I would love that if that were the case. Oh, you are really raising my hopes now for a Natalie win. I am going to blame you. I normally adopt your tactic of pessimism. So well, I've been telling myself, Natalie's not going to win, and now you're raising my hopes, and it's going to destroy me.
It could still be Josh, because he is one of the girls, but I think Natalie is the most likely candidate. And if that theory is true, like, I know some people had Julie in the mix for a while, but I think it's quite clearly not going to be her anymore. So,
well, if she somehow doesn't quit, I think Julie's got a real underdog story building. So I could see Julie as a dark horse.
I don't know. Like you said, it's hard for spray tan owner who is dating John Rocker, who goes out on Survivor and doesn't like the rain, to be edited into some kind of hero. It's just
that's a big task. You've got to have a turning point. I'm going to do the honorary Colin Stone defense of somebody's arc here. She's just going to turn it around after the merge. She's going to have her moment where she comes close to quitting, and she's going to tell Jeff where to take his torch snuffer, and she is going to go forward and rope together the singles and destroy the pairs and become the sole survivor. It could happen.
They could do, but I feel like 29 seasons in, they don't want to put that much work into crafting some kind of massive redemption arc when they could just bury that entirely and show Julie in a very non-offensive light.
Yeah, but on the other hand, she did sort of have that moment where she was saying, you know, I could quit, but I'm still here, and I think that says something. So, I don't know. As I say, I'm still clinging to this hope that somehow this is all a big troll and there is nobody quitting this season. I don't really believe it. I'm just trying to kid myself that we're not going to get yet another quitter. I'm so tired of somebody quitting every season.
Yeah, I want to believe that too. I don't always feel badly towards the person who quits, depending on the circumstances, but for the people who do want Survivor to be this really grueling test of endurance, you can't be surprised when someone isn't up to the task or doesn't end up surviving that the whole way.
That is true.
You can't both complain when they go too easy on them, and then also complain when some people find it too hard when they do take away all these comfort items.
That is a valid point. Anyway, so back to Natalie, though. So you are a clear contender for the win, apparently.
I think so. I just think all of these things are pointing in that direction. And it could very easily be Jeremy. Like, this could be the same coronation edit that we saw with someone like Tyson. But yes. I think it has a lot of room to take a negative turn for Jeremy, where he ends up offending people or being too negative and people don't take kindly to it. Whereas with Natalie, we've seen on other CBS shows that she does have this abrasive side to her personality. And outside of the John Rocker fight, which, like I said, I think was meant to reflect well on her, we really haven't seen anything of that. She's been very measured and level-headed. And maybe that's the reality of how she's acting out there, but maybe she is maybe more on the edge than we're led to believe, but they're hiding that because they don't want people to dislike the person who does end up being their winner.
I'll see. I've sort of taken the opposite view. I think we're not seeing the more obnoxious side of Natalie because they don't feel she's a character worthy. I feel like if she was going to win, we'd be seeing all those things because that's what I love about her. So yeah, I suppose that's the case of which end of the spectrum the Twinnies fans you fall on. That's a maybe production feel that they should be giving her a softer edit.
Sure. One other semi-serious thing. I asked Colin this, I think it was last week, and we couldn't come up with an answer to it. Are Josh and Reed the first gay couple that we've seen on Survivor when you take into account the family visit or any other type of interaction?
Didn't Amy have her girlfriend come out and didn't they kiss or something?
Amy and Christy, yeah. And I
Vanuatu.
That's a good kind of segue, actually, because I know there was some debate at the time about whether they showed that responsibly or not. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this as well, because we heard Jeremy react very negatively to their kind of display of emotion. I didn't get the sense that there was anything beyond just Jeremy being negative and complaining, but did you feel like there's any kind of undercurrent there?
No, going back to Jeremy's twin brother, who is apparently gay. So I do not think... And called Josh, yes. I don't know if you... Because I'm a How I Met Your Mother fan, I was kind of half hoping he would then go on and say, oh, and he's also white. Yeah, so I don't think there's any homophobia there. I think that's just Jeremy being grouchy and going, oh, well, if Val and I were here, we'd be pretending we weren't married because that would be a death knell if people thought we were in love with each other, you know.
Which is just patently absurd, right? Like, how are
I know.
You,
I
are
am
people just supposed to forget?
I am fully in support of Josh and Reed enjoying their time together and John and Jacqueline. You know, nobody is under any illusions here. It's not like it's a showmance where you're starting to snuggle up and be all smoochy, because then you become a target. But when you everybody's come into the game with their loved one and their target, you know, it's pretending that's not happening is not going to work.
I heard someone say they get a Desperate Housewives vibe from Josh and Reed, which I kind of see, but I don't think there's anything sinister to it. They just seem like a very interesting and very just relatable couple.
I've never watched Desperate Housewives, so I can't tell you. But I like them. I think they seem a very nice couple. Not really much to say of that. It's like, yeah, enjoy yourself on the beach there. There's not much to enjoy about Survivor when you really get down to it. Sure. So enjoy your time with each other. I like the fact that they are so excited to share this experience with each other.
Do you think that whole blood versus water concept is working this season? And if it is it working in the same way that it did the first time, or is there some new element there that you find more attractive here?
Now that you come to mention it, I think the blood versus water element is actually working better this season, because last season, you know, so many of the pairs got broken up, and really the only time the blood versus water thing came to effect was either with the Redemption Arena or when Sierra voted out her mother. There wasn't really anything else that connected. The big advantage we had last season was because half of them were returning players, the other half had a much better association with Survivor than this cast do. So we were seeing more aggressive gameplay. But we are seeing a lot more of the relationships. I know a lot of people have been saying, oh, because they're not returning players and we don't know them, it's harder to get a feel for these relationships. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's easier to accept the relationships as they're presented to us, because it's not, oh, it's Tyson and his girlfriend, it's Jervis and his niece. You know, it is these two people at least start off as equals, even if by now it's devoted to, oh, it's Keith and his son, you know.
Right.
But I think we have got so many pairs left in the game, and it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out in the merge when inevitably they start getting voted off. We saw that a bit with Dale, where his daughter was voted off and he had to go back and play nice to everybody. And I don't think we really got that in the first season, because although we had it with Vitas and Aris and Tina and Katie, it was so much a case where they were outnumbered and they were being told they went very quickly after each other. I suppose Katie was the exception, but I don't think Katie wasn't so emotionally invested in the game anyway. We didn't really get the emotions coming into play after the merge, and I think this season we will.
Sure. So let's look ahead to that merge then. What do you see playing out? Like, this is your time to call your shot.
Okay, so Bayla and Missy are going to be like the core couple here, and they've got John and Jacqueline, and I'm assuming that Keith did know about the vote split, and maybe Missy said to him, "Look, if he plays an idol, just play yours." Although that wouldn't make sense, because then she'd go home. But you know, But so maybe he was thinking, oh, I can play my idol if he plays his. So he, but he, let's just assume that Missy has him on side still. So she has Keith. That may mean she gets Wes in. And everybody's sort of agreeing that Josh and Reed, Reed's very good in challenges. Reed isn't to be trusted. Josh is obviously a player, got a lot of connections. Let's get them out now while we have the numbers. And then we still have room. We'll still be six prepared people versus five single people. So they can do that. And so that's what I think is going to happen. The first crash is going to go on Josh and Reed. Maybe they can pull it around if they can get Keith with them and perhaps get the singles working with them. But I think Josh and Reed are going to be the first target, so we'll assume that. I'll say Reed wins immunity, Josh goes out, Reed follows fairly soon after, unless he gets on an immunity streak. And then John and Jacqueline will be taken out mid-game because they're too nice and threatening to get to the end. And it's going to be the Jeremy, Natalie, Baylor, and Missy are sort of going to be fighting it out between themselves. And it's whether they decide to beat Natalie to be the third for Baylor and Missy, or whether Jeremy and Natalie make a power play in their own right. So I think that's going to be the big question of who's going to emerge on top, Jeremy and Natalie as a pair, or Baylor and Missy as a pair.
Yeah, I think the first part of what you said is pretty much right. Like, I see Jeremy, Julie, and Natalie being that threesome, Missy and Baylor coming over, and Natalie being the pivot between all of that, and then Missy maybe brings in Keith. Either way, I think John and Jacqueline, whether or not they're consciously involved with that, will vote that way anyway, because they might think that Missy and Baylor are still with them, and also now they have Jeremy and the others clamped on as well. So that's mm-hmm. going to be the big majority for the first few votes. And then Josh is going to be the first casualty, then Reed. And so episodes 8 through 10 might be fairly boring if it just leads to Wes and then Anik and then Reed in some order being picked off. Unless, as you say, John and Jacqueline become too much of a target and they get broken up. I could see that happening, actually. And then let's say you vote out John, you may as well vote out Jacqueline immediately after that, right? So that buys someone like Wes two more rounds, I suppose, but...
Well, I think the play for Jeremy and Natalie is to promote themselves as a pair, but then break the pairs up and push a singles alliance. So you get... Maybe you get both Josh and Reed out because you don't trust them, but then you break John and Jacqueline up and you take the surviving member, say Jacqueline, say, look, let's stick together, and then overthrow Missy and Baylor. Or Wes and Keith. So That's the kind of thing that I'm looking for, is at some point there going to be a shift from the singles to really grab power, or will it be this case of everybody's going to buddy up and have their own, you know, dual person, and people like, there'll be a few floaters like Julie, if she's there, and other surviving fivers of pairs who become thirds for the swing vote. I don't think it's going to be a case of you vote somebody out and then you vote their loved one out straight away. There's going to be a few cases where that loved one's going to be lingering around being a swing vote.
Okay. I think if you see Jeremy, Julie, and Natalie as this tight three, then that's just as threatening, if not even more so, than any of the pairs. But I'm not sure that anybody does see them that way at the moment. I think it's more, okay, they're all singletons and they were all on my original tribe, but the three of them in particular might not have anything going on together. It's more or they're just kind of stuck together by circumstance. So if they're able to avoid that perception, then you are going to have all of the couples being targeted, I think. I think Missy and Baylor in particular, for as long as they're in the game, they will be the center of attention, not just because of their personalities, but also because they're going to be the swing vote sometimes and they're going to be the ones that the people on the bottom go to try and make something happen. And so if they can keep Missy and Baylor around, that's always going to be a bigger target than anybody else left in the game. So that might be a wise play for all of them.
Yeah, and I know you keep sort of working on this assumption that Wes is going to be taken out relatively early, but I could see Wes and Keith being the pair that flies through the cracks, under the radar and falls through the cracks, because they're partly because they haven't been together at any point during the game, and partly because they're father and son, and it's just a less of a bond so to speak, than the other pairs have. I know they shouldn't really be any more distant than Baylor and Missy, but I think we can clearly say that they have a very different relationship to Baylor and Missy. So I could see them ending up the last pair standing and maybe being able to wield some influence there and getting a sort of a surprise turnaround at the end. But, yeah, I can see Wes and Keith going further than you think.
Okay. I could see Wes being that guy that there seems to be every other season, where you get down to Final Six or Final Seven and there's one person left who doesn't really have any role to play, hasn't really got any screen time at all, and you almost like take an episode off to get rid of that person, and then all the infighting resumes again.
That's also quite possible, isn't it? Yeah, you do get that person.
Yeah, like the Carter of the season. Yes. So is there anything else you want to get to today, do you think?
Actually, one thing I wanted to, watching this episode, you have that moment where, you know, John does this vote off of Dale, somebody who's been making these passionate pleas to him. And John watches this torch get snuffed and turns to Jacqueline and go, oh, you're so beautiful. And it's such a sociopathic thing to say. And what? It's made...
How so?
Well, it's like, you've just, you know, crushed this guy's dreams. And all you could think about is, oh, you look pretty, dear. And it just made me wonder, is the... having a loved one there, does it actually enable sociopathic behaviour? Because normally on Survivor, you're out there on your own, and you've got to form emotional bonds with these people you're voting off, because otherwise you'll go crazy. And you need to, because you're going through this really traumatic experience. And so people speak about these heavy bonds they develop, this sort of accelerated relationship process. Whereas on a blood versus water season, if in the case of people like John and Jacqueline, they've suddenly got each other, and they don't have to care about anybody else because they know they've got that one person who loves them. So you can be a lot more, oh, it's just a game, let's get rid of this guy. And I'm wondering if that's going to come into play, if we're going to see more callous moves, so to speak.
That's interesting. I don't get the sense that John was being outright malicious about that or anything. I think it's more
I don't think he was. It was just so... he just seemed to have no care. It was just this very cold-hearted, objective, okay, well, that's Dale done. Don't you look nice tonight? And it was just weird. It's not the, that's hard to see Dale go. That was a tough one to do. It was.
Yeah. I get the sense that John just doesn't really take anything too seriously, including Survivor. It's more just he's happy to be there and he's having a good time and his girlfriend's there with him, so why not enjoy that? I do think you make a really good point there, because normally on a season of Survivor, if you're thinking about the game in the way that you should always be making an active effort to spend time with people and form relationships, even though in your heart of hearts you might not want to. And it's much more difficult to justify doing that to yourself when, instead of spending 10 minutes with Baylor, who you really don't like, you could go back and spend that time with the love of your life, who's on the beach over there, right?
Yeah, and then if you're not putting that investment into making a friendship with the person to be your emotional support, it's, you then don't care about voting them off. It's, you know, we see it time and time again. People return from tribal council going, oh, that was so hard. But when you've got your loved one to be with, you don't need those people on an emotional level. You might need them as numbers, but then it's easier if you just look at them as numbers.
Yeah, and also you see people a lot saying, oh, well, I'm out here to win the money for my family. I'm doing this because, you know, that's my first alliance in life, that kind of thing. And it's easy to say that, but then when they're back at home and you're out here forming relationships with these people, it's hard to really weigh that up properly. But when your family is out there with you on the island, it's very easy to say, well, either I vote you off or Jacqueline and I aren't going to get the money, and that's a pretty easy choice for me to make.
Yeah, and Missy and Baylor, that's another couple where that's really going to come into play. It's going to be much easier for Missy to vote off all these people she's been mothering when she's got her actual daughter right there.
Yeah, and so it is easy to keep your partner in line as well. Like, they might think, oh, I want to be loyal to this person until the end, even though they might beat me. But if your husband or your wife is there, or your mother, and she's saying, and she's trying to explain the logic to you of what you have to do, then you're going to listen to them, maybe, whereas you wouldn't listen to another stranger who you also met 39 days ago.
Yeah, if you go back to Philippines, we had Lisa Welchel's family visit, where she'd been sort of so mopey and unhappy throughout the game. And then her brother who came out?
Yeah, Justice.
And he reminded her, you know, it's a game. Go play it. Go try and win. And she goes, oh, all right then. And she started getting a lot more ruthless. She was still crying a lot, but, you know, sure. She was a lot more comfortable with what she was doing in the context of the game because she'd had that reminder of who she was doing it for.
Or even Denise in that same season where going into the Final Four, she was saying, if Malcolm had just said to me, I'm voting with you, I would be happy to take him to the end, even though I knew I would probably lose to him. If her husband or her kids were out there with her, I don't think she would make that same calculation.
Yes, I think that's so true. It's easy to say, no, you just met this guy 30 days ago. Stop being loyal, play for yourself. But I can imagine when you're out there, it's probably very hard to get out of that alliance mentality, whereas we're working together. I want one of us to win. I don't care if it's him instead of me, you know.
What do you think goes into that attitude of placing loyalty above a sheer business-minded view of the money? Because we've seen this a lot on most recent season of Survivor and of Big Brother, and then Denise almost made that same mistake as well. What do you think it is that makes people prize this abstract concept above money that they know when they get home they can use to pay their mortgage or put their kids through college or any number of real life-altering things?
I can't speak for Big Brother because I don't watch it. That's far too much of a time sink. I certainly for Survivor, you're out there in the elements. You're getting beaten down. You're hungry. You're cold. And you're basically killing people every 3 days. And it is such an immersive and traumatic experience that you are going to form very emotional bonds. And I can imagine it's a lot harder to put yourself back in what your home, sitting on the sofa watching television with your family and knowing that the right thing to do is to go for the money, to go for the win. So I think, it's Cochrane said in Carimone, because Cochrane was really a jerk in his confessionals in Carimone, and he said it was really hard for him to watch that when he got back, but part of it was just a defense mechanism, you know, make fun of these people because I can't get to like them so much that I can't vote them off, you know. And I think it's one of the underrated things. Everyone says, you know, oh, I'm not coming out here to make friends, but A, you have to make friends to get through the game. And B, you've somehow got to find a way of balancing that with not making such, with keeping this perspective that these are not your family. You know, we hear a lot about, oh, my island family. Survivors talk about that, use that term. But yeah, it's something you can't understand if you haven't played, I assume.
Yeah, and you saw that contrast in that season between Cochrane and Dawn, who it seemed like every time she had to vote someone off, went through like this existential crisis where it's just how she saw herself as like this loving Mormon mother of 20 kids or whatever, where, you know, she really couldn't overcome that contradiction in her own mind.
And Dawn was somebody who did keep in this thing, I am doing it for my kids, you know, I've got to vote these people off because I'm out here to win for my kids. My family have let me disappear for 6 weeks a second time. I've got to bring back the money or their sacrifice isn't worth it. And she was just incredibly conflicted that whole time. She'd set way too much emotional pressure on herself. She's a nice person who genuinely cared about these people and was just struggling with everything about it, whereas Cochrane was able to stay a lot more dispassionate.
Sure. So on that cheerful note, any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
No, I think that was it.
Wonderful. So is there anything you want to plug? Anywhere that people can reach you if they want to?
Oh, you can follow me on Twitter at ChannonSarah, ChannonSarah. Hopefully I'll be getting around to putting a blog on RHAP sometime this season, at least put one on, assuming they let me.
I'm sure
we're all there entirely on sufferance. So.
Sure.
And I will be back for season 30, so don't think I've abandoned it altogether. I'm excited to get back into the game.
Yeah, and we will put a note to the blog archive in the show notes if you want to go back and check out Sarah's blog from previous seasons. So unless there's anything else, I think we can get out of here.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me on. It's been so much fun to finally get out all these thoughts I've had.
No problem. It's been a pleasure. And hopefully we'll have Colin back next week, but if not, then we'll find someone else to fill the void. So we'll
Okay,
see you next week,
British.
guys. Take care.
Somebody else British. Let's just take over.
Brits,
All
Canadians,
right.
I don't mind anything. Any former British
Canadian will
colony
come.
can fine.
Yes,
Fine.
all right.
See you next week,
Okay.
everyone.
Bye.